Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Representing for a second time, Whip Snakes Lacrosse Club!
Oh! Chase, was that you?
Oh, no.
Uh-oh.
Did you break the trophy?
No.
Yeah, it was, that was pretty crazy.
He shoots and scores! What? What?
Ice cream! Woo!
Hello and welcome back to the final PLL Happy Hour podcast of the season. Alongside Chris Rosenthal, I'm Kevin Brown. Rosie, Utah Archers have done it. They've repeated, joining the Maryland Whipsnakes as two-time champions, the only two franchises in the PLL era to protect their crown successfully. Go back-to-back with championships. 12-8 win. Brett Dobson, back-to-back championship MVPs. The first time that's happened in the last 10 years. Rosie, what'd you think of the game? And how about this Utah dynasty that's forming up here?
Right. Well, you know, they say, right, offense wins games, defense wins championships. And sometimes that feels like a silly, lazy cliche, and sometimes it feels very, very accurate. And I would say this time was definitely the latter. Brett Dobson, unbelievable generally all year long, but absolutely in the postseason, another signature performance. It's incredible to think that this is only his second full season and, you know, his third season total, and you're already looking at somebody with a Hall of Fame resume already.
Yeah. You're not kidding. Like, to go back-to-back years winning the championship MVP honors, no one's done it since John Grant Jr. when he did it with the Bayhawks and Denver Outlaws. Kind of impressive that he did it with two different teams in 2013 and 2014 back in the Major League Lacrosse era, but now it's a... It's the Archers' time. They bided their time first 4 years in this league. They're just chomping at the bit to get past that second round, past the semifinals, and into the title game. Finally do last year. Brett Dobson comes up clutch with that save. And to do it again in what to me felt like a far more dominant, like, he knew he was the reigning championship MVP. He's been there, done that type of performance. And it really helped the Archers stay in it early. The Whipsnakes did brilliantly to kind of come out and throw that first punch, right, with Rambo scoring less than 30 seconds in after Joe Nardello got that one to go. I was like, all right. Rosie, here we go. We're ready for a little back and forth melee here. It's Rambo and Philly, and then it's all of a sudden it's a 3-0, 4-1 lead after O'Keefe's goal was ruled out too. What'd you make of that kind of initial Whipsnakes push?
Yeah, so Maryland really just kind of kicked the door in, right? They set the tone early when Rambo scored that goal, which was very, very similar to his, you know, championship-winning goal on that same field, and that's literally on that same side of the field in 2019. And the way he celebrated it after turning the corner and burying it on Sunday, I was like, okay, you know, Maryland is rolling out, giving their best effort. You know, they are ready to take the fight to the Archers. And the Archers did not look composed to start, right? Like, you know, they couldn't get into a settled offense. They were kind of rushing things. They looked a lot more nervous to be, you know, trying to hang on to the title, while the Whipsnakes were really kind of all in their faces, trying to take the title from them. So as soon as Rambo hits that one, I'm thinking it's going to be a long day for the Archers. And then they had their share of turnovers, and especially when the goal got waved off, it just felt like, you know, all the energy, all the momentum was favoring the Whipsnakes, and you just had to think maybe if the Archers could hold on, they could eventually get their footing back. And that is really what I thought locked it up for Brett Dobson. Like, right away, I thought, barring some particularly spectacular offensive performance by somebody, the fact that Dobson was just standing on his head early and giving the rest of his team kind of a chance to calm down and finally start producing the way that they had done earlier in the season. You know, I said something like this at the time, like if there's a mediocre goalie in that cage, the game's over after like 6 minutes, I'd say something like that. Because the Whipsnakes just came out doing exactly what they wanted. They just couldn't convert on all of their opportunities. And that is solely thanks to Dobson.
Yeah, the first few saves really stood out. And like you mentioned, sloppiness on both ends. Trey Leclerc kind of has this sloppy force right into the middle, and the Whipsnakes were great at collapsing the crease really all throughout that first half and throughout the game, which kind of lent itself to some opportunities for Leclerc that we'll get to. But the fact that Dobson was so unfazed, doing all of this, standing on his head early on, not even with this stick. Mac O'Keefe reveals post-game that he breaks Dobson's head during warm-ups, like the last shot of warm-ups. What a bad omen that is. And the Whipsnakes definitely proved that omen to be true for that first bit. Dobson overthrows Robbins on that clear, and they looked rattled, right? Like DJ Malone started connecting with Ryan Conrad, the first of three assists to him on the day. And then Van Overbeek, he gets his chance. He stays in the lineup, but he has a bad force to the crease, a little BTB attempt, not coming off. Looked nowhere else but to Dobson to settle the storm. And at the end of the first quarter, Rosie, I'm really impressed with the way Matt Moore kind of asserted himself against Ajax Apatella on this one. And it starts with that spinorama and get underneath for the underhand finish. Oh, my goodness. He takes a nice little lick, a nice little hit after the end of this one. And we saw it in the press box. I don't remember how much they showed it on the broadcast, but you could clearly tell he was shaken up after, I think it was Dunn or Mueller came over there. Dunn, I think. And then he doesn't start the second quarter. Fine to finish the game. He comes back in, but just a general representation of the kind of toughness you got to show, no matter how injured. He misses those games with the shoulder injury earlier in the season. No matter how hurt you are, championship game, you got to leave it all on the line.
Yeah, that's a really good point about Moore, because, you know, while he was gone with the injury, he came back and had like a diving backhand, you know, just barely crossing GLE. And when I saw him do that, I was like, in the semis. And I was like, okay, he must be feeling much better. Because, you know, there's like a period of time if you get hurt where you're still not exactly sure you're 100%, or you're a little bit cautious of doing something that could aggravate, you know, your injury. But just seeing that, and it's almost kind of like a mental hangup, right? And seeing that he was, you know, in a good enough headspace where he was willing to try something like that made me think, okay, he's going to be ready to go 100% for this game today. But yeah, like you mentioned, first quarter, he's barely making it off the field. Like, you know, he had to stop several times and was kind of doubled over on his way off the field. Finally got to the penalty box or the substitution box, and he's doubled over, like all fours. They kind of have to go help him the rest of the way to the bench, and then they start draping towels over him. Somebody comes over and has a towel in front of him, I'm assuming to block any sort of camera guy from getting in there to see that sort of thing. So he looked awful. You know, I didn't know exactly what was going on. It could have been a cramping issue. Like you said, he took that hit, so maybe it was something there. But yeah, again, like you said, didn't start that second quarter. They kind of had to find a way to incorporate him into the game after that. And, you know, once he started subbing through the box a little bit more, and finally getting resettled to, you know, shaking off whatever he was dealing with early enough. He sprung back to life again, kind of shot back up to 100%. And that's kind of what this team has been about, you know, kind of shaking one thing off and, you know, finding a different way to rally. And, you know, he was definitely a big symbol of that in this game.
Yeah, absolutely. Just playing without their reigning MVP, Tom Schreiber. They were without Connor Fields in last year's title game. That didn't matter. Without Schreiber this year, didn't matter. Just speaks to the depth that Coach Chris Bates has cultivated throughout these years. To have both Moore and a similar body in Trey LeClair, just ample depth to compete at the very highest level in these games. Then you see Moore do what he did. It's inspiring. It really gets the boys going. And when so the Archers throw a punch back, but second quarter comes around, and I thought this was real indicative of the type of season that he's had. But Adam Poitras, man, scores the second goal right away, right off the faceoff. And just his, like, swarming movements when he, like, dives in there downhill coming from, like, a straight line with those 10 yards out of the midfield. So dangerous. And he beats Dauber near side to make it 4-1. Then play of the game happened, Rosie.
What
do we have? The... another lengthy Whipsnakes possession at this point. Dobson's around like 8 or 9 saves. Rambo, he turns back right. Pretty easy stop for Dauber at that angle. Not like his first quarter one, where I think Dauber really anticipated well what he was going to do. Like the diving right-handed question mark was, I thought, one of his best early saves. Then to quickly get the outlet out, he sees Woodward's guarding Malone out top. Malone doesn't get back. Woodward, way to run the break, man. O'Keefe gets a great look, shoots right at Krebs. Woodward makes just the play of the game, like I said, to strip Conrad and to go for that two-pointer. Rosie, like, the score a two-pointer at that stage as a rookie defenseman. I mean, he's caught kind of fire in transition the second half of the season here, but doing it in the championships a whole other ball game. So, I mean, just what did that do for the Utah momentum?
It must have been so huge, you know, because you're falling behind significantly, right? Like, you are finding yourself not only in a hole scoreboard-wise, but there's got to be a sense of frustration. Like, you know, we're kind of looking like trash at some moments here. You know, like you mentioned that, yeah, that behind-the-back feed attempt. It feels like it would be incredibly demoralizing to have a turnover on something that isn't like a routine sort of pass or something like that. It's like a home run pass sort of thing, right? Especially if your opponent goes down and capitalizes on something like that. So the ability to hit like a two-pointer, we just heard so much about the kind of juice it can instantly provide, let alone a two-pointer from a rookie, you know, let alone a two-pointer from a pole, a traditionally close defense pole, you know, not so much a guy like your Tyler Carpenter or something like that. Granted, that would still be a huge juice play. But this was, if I'm not 100% certain, I think it was just his second two-pointer of the year. He's not a, you know, running down five times a game looking to drop two-pointers. So just everybody kind of gets fired back up from that sort of thing. It's like, hey, we're not as far out as we think we are. This is a big Uno reversal card kind of situation to play. And I think it was evident by just the way the team rallied afterwards.
There's two real game-defining goals in this one that counted for two from Mason Woodward's cross, and then at the end of the third quarter we'll get to just the quarter buzzer beating goal from Dyson Williams. Archers do a great job, I think maybe better than anyone in the league. When they get a momentum play like that, they pile it on, and Sis got a couple face-offs. They score, I think, off both goals the next two offensive possessions. This time it's LeClaire getting an open look from Fields carrying up the wing. Nice little through pass from him. And what I loved about that set, you got O'Keefe kind of just floating in two-point land. So Mueller can't help off him because you don't want to give him any outside room for step-down shooting. So more master kind of play offensive set design from Bates and company. But the next play after that, they get the next face-off again. Ambler sprints right to the crease to take the pull away. Amen takes advantage. Zapatello ends up the one switching on him, but the lefty rolled back without much angle too, mind you. Just all of a sudden they're in the lead. it's incredible. It's just like that. 5-4 game, and I think what could have helped in terms of the overall dramatics from a neutral point of view was taken away with a PLL first. I confirmed with Seth Tierney post game that it was in fact the first time he's had to call this rule where LSM Alex Mazzone wound up, thought he had the perfect answer for Woodward's two pointer, and Rosie, sometimes that's just the way it goes. The head flies off before the ball is in the net, and thusly, a rare rule in the PLL notebook is utilized in the championship game. Not allowed to be deemed a shot, and what the Archers really get away with one.
Yeah. Do you know how many weird things have to sync up exactly right for Mazzone's head to go flying off during an otherwise successful two-pointer in the championship? Like, did a screw fall out this, you know, the morning of the game? Has he been playing without it all season? Was it in there and it like rusted part of it off?
You know, which Archer was messing with it on the sideline.
Right. There's got to be, I mean, you could try this like 1,000 times and that wouldn't happen, you know, because if he shot it and it went wide, we don't even talk about it anymore. You know, so many weird things have to line up exactly right for that to happen. And in such an important part of the game, right? Like, what does happen if they take the lead back on that play? You know, do the Archers have it in them to kind of, you know, buckle down and mount another comeback? Or are they, you know, like, well, that was all the effort we had. You know, are they out of gas after the last comeback? So many outcomes and possibilities we will never know because that head went flying off. So incredibly weird. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. And probably never will again. It's like Randy Johnson throwing a pitch and hitting a bird, right? Like, why was the bird literally there at the exact time that the pitch went past? You know, you could.
I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm cutting Mazzone as much slack. Like, you got to have your head on as tight as possible for the championship game.
Yeah, I mean, did he just choose not to have a screw in it? You know, like,
no, I'm not saying that's the case, but yeah, who knows what? Like, it was just the head that flew off, so yeah. It was definitely a screw was a little loose.
I mean,
it has to be.
My head has never flown off in a lacrosse game. I don't know what made it do that. I would be scared to ask him.
But
I would
really
be very curious. Maybe a little later. He's probably kind of salty about it right now, but we'll see.
So if there's anyone that's super re-energized from getting this break and keeping the lead, it's Dobson. It's he arguably has probably his second best stretch of the game, when the first being at the end of that third quarter, but Rosie, in the semifinals, he kind of said Xander Dixon had the yips a little bit. And this one, it was kind of Zed Williams, man. Like, he gets a point-blank look from Poitras, and it's like the very next possession after this Mazzone ordeal. And he's wide open right on the doorstep. And you just absolutely stuffed, and it does, like, he kind of does his, like, quick, wants to get it between the goalie's legs real quick without a fake. And Dauber was there. He's there to meet it, and I think it's part Dauber preparation. He talks about how much of a lax rat, if you remember last year, this very show had him on as the championship MVP guest. He said it throughout the post game following this one, just how much he loves watching film on these guys. You watch every single shot, every single game that they've played all season and chart it, or kind of write notes about it. So he's dialed in, man. Like the, but at the same time, what do you think about the kind of the Williams misses in this one until that late goal gave him, I think, what, their eighth and their seventh and final goal? Yeah. Second to last goal.
Well, I think one remarkable thing about this game as far as Whipsnake's production goes, you look at the top three scorers, and it's all a testament to, you know, I kind of banging a drum earlier about like Stags being a GM of the year sort of thing, right? Their top three scorers, Malone, draft pick, Conrad traded this year, and Adam Patra, draft pick.
Yeah.
The guys that you would have, counted on to deliver or assumed would deliver based on their pasts, you know, as MVPs and attackmen of the year kinds of things. You know, Rambo and Williams shoot 2 for 17 combined. Granted, a good amount of credit does go to Dobson. Like you mentioned, he is a super, super hyper-focused on tendencies and getting these shots exactly where he wants them and teaching his defenders exactly what to do to make it happen. So he is a step ahead of, you know, the rest of the game, it seems, most of the time. But, you know, you can't ignore big stage, big game, relative silence from these guys. And, some of it was bad luck. You know, I know Rambo hit a crossbar early on, you know, an inch lower. It's a different sort of situation. But, you know, the final result is what it is. It was not an incredibly productive game from either of the more traditional veteran Whipsnake producers.
Yeah, Bridging the Arrows was my title to get them to the title game, but that old guard, the veterans of this team really couldn't, besides that early Rambo strike, couldn't get much past Dobson. And for those two in particular, it's really cool just because it comes full circle from an Archer's point of view. After that bubble season, they said, hey, we got to beef up on defense. And Graham Hossett comes, Warren Jeffrey the next year. Whipsnakes were a class of the league with those two guys leading the charge the first two championships. A couple years later, they're kind of not a backseat to TJ Malone, but certainly in secondary and third roles to his quarterbacking. So it's testament to Hossett and Jeffrey matching beef, man. Love the amount of beef that was on that end of the field. It was beefed up. So, but the most impressive performance, arguably, of all three of them was Mason Woodward. Obviously, I think he had the play of the game, but to hold Malone scoreless takes quite a bit of attention on ball and really off ball. Like, you see Malone do it all throughout the season. He just racks up points because he's so good at both. He still manages to lead them in points with 4 assists. But it's only the second time all season that he's held to without a goal. So a lot of credit goes to Woodward down there. And the defensive midfielders, too, it's a collective effort. Listen, the Bo Patterson, Connor Marr, and Piper Bond, Piper and Connor growing up together in Baltimore area and now kind of doing their thing. Second year, so all of a sudden they're veterans. With Patterson and Woody coming into the defense, it's really hard to beat this group. Cam Wires, he's good to go. He does well, doesn't really make any mistakes, But John Robbins is, I don't know if you, like, after the first drive, Levi Anderson knocked him off his kind of line. But John Robbins was as tough as can be in this one. Tough ground balls on the porch and tough meeting Levi out for those kind of confrontations throughout. It was just all six defensemen in that group is really fun to watch. So kind of keeping through this game, Dobson gets another kick save against Rambo. Kind of a lucky break to tie it up at halftime. Malone kind of not a force feed, but tries to get it to Williams on the crease. Great collapse from Hasek, and Conrad just comes out of nowhere. Shows that championship pedigree. We talk about Mac O'Keefe being in the championship game every year of his career. Conrad has been in the last three as well, two with the Water Dogs, now his first with Maryland. He finishes that up, tied at five, going into the break. I don't want to toot my own horn too much with this because it was simply just watching the highlights of their previous meeting.
Let's go.
And in the semifinal preview, I was super impressed with how well Mac O'Keefe beat the Whipsnakes off the dribble. He's known as a step-down shooter, and a couple times in this one, most significantly to start the second half scoring. No answers, kind of looking for somewhere to go offensively, and Mac O'Keefe goes right. Tim Muller kind of, whoa, off guard a little bit there, and he gets it to go. So, like, Rosie, just when you... When O'Keefe does that, like, what are you supposed to do defensively? Because you pick your poison with that offense, man.
100%. So this was a huge, huge story of this game. And I think if we had to pick a secondary MVP, or, like, you know, if for some reason Dobson couldn't win it again for some reason, I would give it to Mac O'Keefe. And exactly like you said. So,
over Woodward?
We'll say yes. If I already said so, then yes. It certainly could have been Woodward as well. But so, like, what we heard after the game from Jim Stagnita in the press conference was, you know, he's like, listen, we knew Grant Amont and we knew Connor Fields. We wanted to focus on them. You know, they're the two leading scorers on the team, right? And so they wanted to dedicate as much attention as they could to shutting them down. And not only that, but kind of doing the Whipsnakes thing, which is only letting you beat them one way, right? You're not going to get your 3-3. You know, maybe you'll get a couple assists, but you're not going to score any goals or vice versa. But that's kind of their emphasis, right? So we did know in hindsight that that's the strategy. They're like, we got to shut these other two guys down. And so what that does is, as we saw, Mac O'Keefe basically has two choices. He's like, I'm not going to get assist opportunities here. If I'm going to produce, I'm going to have to do it myself, right? And so O'Keefe, who came into this game leading the league in assisted shots, and, you know, which isn't a surprise, you know, just having seen his style and, you know, how he's been productive over the years, he's just a super carrier, right? He's just dodging. And not only is he not settling for outside shots, he was just weaving his way through traffic. You know, he's just kind of doing boxish sort of fakes and waving his stick from side to side, but also making sure it's always ready to get back into a strong position to shoot. And, you know, the shots he buried were probably about 3 feet away from the cage, and that was due to his own initiative dodging through everybody. So it was just so huge for this team. And again, one thing they're really, really good at is everybody being very skilled at more than one thing, right? I think that's a huge part of the Archers' success. And in this particular sort of situation, all of a sudden, you know, set shooting, you know, Klay Thompson-ish, you know, come off of a pick and just catch it and fire it, Mac O'Keefe is all of a sudden like this number one dodger who's just going straight to the cage past everyone. And, you know, when he starts burying those, what are you going to do with the rest of your defensive strategy if it's just stopping, you know, Grant Amont and Connor Field? Are you going to not cover those guys? So I mean, that was a huge thing. They gave the opportunity, part of their strategy, right? Give them the opportunity and hope they can stop them. Oh, but he made them pay for it.
He did it in the first meeting. It was arguably a lot harder. The difficulty shots that he was taking in that 16-11 win back in Boston and earlier in the regular season, he was just shooting right through Mahler, like sweeping across. This time, like, he at least takes it all the way to the doorstep and then gets it in. So, no, like, you put it there perfectly, and this, we will have plenty of praise for the archers throughout this pod, but little praise for the Whipsnakes' man-down unit. Did not allow a single goal all season. Kudos to you guys, pro lacrosse record, to go completely perfect man down. I thought a good embodiment was right after this goal. They go man down on off the faceoff. I think it's a pushing penalty or something. Colin Squires, he's been so active all year. Great knockdown, gets the GB, and even draws the flag on the other end. And I think this next sequence was really indicative of the type of luck that the Whips were getting all game. Malone perfectly sets up Chaney for an open look right at the point, and I think ESPN's broadcast view did a nice job of, rather than the press box view that we had, showing just how straight on this shot was. Like, he had a good look. Levi Anderson just can't get out of the way. Hits his leg, hits Rambo, goes out of bounds. They don't say it's not a shot, I guess, somehow anymore. And Archer's ball. Sometimes that's just the amount of luck, like from the Mazone crazy head play to the ball taking that crazy of a deflection off Levi to go off Rambo to go out of bounds. Like, sometimes it's just not your day, but the Whipsnakes kept battling. And the Mr. Undersong hero himself, Ryan Ambler, just does it again. Like, he gets it at the end of this third quarter. And for him to throw that underhand pass to Dyson Williams, nice little pick game on the crease to free him up, confuse the off-ball guys a little bit. Fake and finish, man. 0.8 seconds left in that third quarter. Just, are you completely deflated? A little bit deflated from a Whipsnakes point of view? Like, how are you feeling? Like, how much are you still in this game after you give up a buzzer beater goal like that?
That is the kind of goal that definitely feels like more than 1 point. You know what I mean? Like, it's 1 point on the scoreboard, but if you're thinking, okay, let's just get this to the fourth quarter, we'll regroup during our break and figure a way to come out strong, right? And then, what, 0.8 seconds left? Not only does he score, right? Because if it's a great play, you know, you're going to give up some shots, right? These guys are offensive geniuses. You're going to give up some shots. But it's not just that it's a shot. It's a shot right on the crease with just a broken defensive scheme. You know, the short stick who was covering him got turned around a little bit and kind of, I don't know if it was by design, but like a communication error, or he just thought he was covering Williams, but he wasn't. But he kind of picked up someone cutting through. And next thing you know, obviously Williams sees this and is like, okay, this thing is a mile wide open. Just breaks to the goal perfectly. And that must be super demoralizing, not just to give up the goal, but to do it in a way that seems so preventable, right? Because it's not a situation where you're playing your best or, okay, they got that one just because, you know, they're really talented. That's like, oh, we screwed up and they made us pay for it, right? So it's real easy to get in your own head when it's literally your fault that they score, right? Or that it's literal breakdown that they score. And so, yeah, but no, shout out to Ryan Ambler for that phenomenal pass. Shout out to Dyson Williams for doing his thing and for having an amazing game. It was that one shot and one goal on the day.
Yep, 100% agree.
That's how you win a championship. That's how it does. Let me say this. Double shout out to Ryan Ambler, right? Because he spoke with us during media day. And two things he emphasized was assistant coach Brian Kavanaugh's masterful substitution game. And he also made sure to talk about Dyson Williams' off-ball cutting and how smart it was relative to the rest of the offense and how it like gets everybody pumped up to see how hard he sprints on these cuts and things like that. And so, you know, fast forward 48 hours or whatever it is, and Ryan Ambler's out there gunning a pass over to a quick-cutting Dyson Williams. He basically called that shot ahead of time. So, shout out to him.
I'll raise you a double shout out with a double shout out for Dyson Williams, because he just a good part to bring up that he grew up with Dauber. The two were ball boys. I listened back to Dobson's appearance on this podcast last year, and Dobson's talking all about even this. So this is before Dyson Williams was even drafted by the Archers. The two guys were ball boys together for Sean Williams' Toronto Nationals back in the MLL days. So that was a really cool tidbit to kind of circle back on to see them. So they won junior and championships indoor growing up together in Ontario, and to see them reigniting that, rekindling that title-winning spirit at this level is super cool. But to my earlier point, so that Archers do a super great job of piling it on, right? You get that momentum at the end of the third quarter. And just a few seconds on this offensive set, because I'm pretty sure this is all correct. But from what I've heard, Chris Bates is the godfather of the Pairs offense. And he must have been smiling at this particular goal. LeClaire's second of the game. I'm talking about Ryan Ambler starts with it, goes down to Mac O'Keefe, acting like he's gonna do that, playing with purpose, of course, and pace that he always does, looking like he's gonna play a little two-man game. O'Keefe circles it right back up to Ament. He gets it over to Matt Moore on the other wing. He does the old pick and pop. Not pick and roll. The picker did not roll to the hoop / net in this case. LeClaire pops off perfectly. It's a perfect throwback from Moore and hammers it top right. Oh my goodness. It was, I just had to describe it like so in detail like that. Just, it was so gorgeous to watch. Bates is kind of known for those offensive sets, and to see it pay off like that. Ament on the very next possession kind of bides his time on the wing. Beautiful cut off ball from O'Keefe, and he throws about 10 million fakes on the crease for the twister finish. By that point, Rosie, it's 10-6, 10 minutes, 36 seconds left in this one. And after the Whipsnakes win two comeback, one goal, playoff games coming in, you're definitely not counting them out yet, right? Like 10.5 minutes left, plenty of time to get back into it. What else you got, Whipsnakes? But Zed Williams, he finally ends that 13-minute scoring drought, and then just the dagger comes through about a minute and a half later. Krebs comes out, makes that beautiful save and transition. Just by beautiful, I mean very unorthodox, by just completely ambushing him. Didn't make it on time to hit him, but he got the save. He was up in his grill to make him not shoot around him, at least. And then he just flips it right to Fields. Fields, easy as you like. Nice little box finish. That's about it. 11-6. 11-7 at that point, excuse me. And then beautiful set play. If I'm going to point out the beautiful offense from the Archers, got to do it for the other side too when they got one. And that was just a beautiful set play call from Drew Snyder to try to fight back. Malone pops off the crease. Rambo hits him, and then nice little backdoor for Chanchuk. Credit to him because he keeps his composure, dives inside for 11-8, cuts the deficit. But Rosie, by the time listeners hear this, they'll be able to read your column about that game live on InsideLacrosse.com. The next play was kind of the ultimate final whistle, by all accounts. Give it to us. Well, what happens next?
Yeah, you know, you need some offense quickly. You need maybe a juice goal or two. You need something to get the troops rallied. And, you know, TJ Malone is your guy. He got you this far. He is the guy. Gets the ball on a restart, and he's ready to drive. Starts going against Woodward. Carries it and ends up ending up in a bad neighborhood. Finds his way over to Graham Hossick's side of the field. Hossick throws one check. Just what? And, you know, and Malone's looking around, and the ball's on the ground. And by the time he basically relocates where the ball went, Hossick has scooped it up and has gone the other way. And, you know, for, I think it is like a big, big picture kind of thing. You look at the phenomenal season Malone had up to that point and phenomenal game he had had as far as being a distributor. You know, we talked about not scoring the goals, but he had dished quite a few assists. Things were going very well for him on an individual basis, but you kind of run into a brick wall there, right? Graham Hossick has been there before, won this championship previously, defenseman of the year, not one to be trifled with, and all the fancy scoring, all the fun that has gone up to that point for Malone and the Whipsnakes kind of gets shut down. The party is canceled at that point. And Hossick's like, okay, you know, thanks for coming out. Maybe some other time you're done. And that's officially it. It was unofficially it, you know, a few minutes prior, but I feel
you
like
you guys have your era.
Yeah. Like, okay, kids, we're done here. And just, you know, it's all done. So that was the bow that got put on it, as far as I was concerned. That's when I was kind of like jotting in my notes. I was like, oh, okay, that clean strip. That's a message delivered. Game over.
100%. The era's bookending the 6 years of PLL history here with the Whipsnakes winning the first two, Archers the most recent two. Play the game ends with teammate of the year, most selfless player in the league, Ryan Ambler. No one else wants this job of running out the clock when the defense is just hounding on you. Roman Pugliese tackles him. He still keeps it. Somehow gets it to the open guy. He gets to the O'Keefe for the hat trick, dunk, easy as like 12-8 win. Congrats to the Utah Archers, man. Just a phenomenal way to repeat as PLL champions here. Any other takes from a holistic point of view, whether it's the Archers successfully repeating or Dobson's feat of repeating as championship MVP? What stands out to you in crossing these eras here?
I would say, so a couple of things. First of all, the Archers really don't seem to be at that point where, you know, you'll see with a lot of pro teams, they're kind of dragging themselves across the finish line. You know, okay, maybe we can get one more before the band breaks up, right? Or maybe we can get one more before we lose the best three players or whatever to retirement or trade demands or something like that. They are a strong team from top to bottom that has really reinforced its strengths. And, you know, that is, they're a solid franchise. You know, they have really managed to build and continue expanding. They don't seem to be perched on any sort of delicate, shaky ground. You know, we mentioned earlier with several guys being able to do different things, that really creates a situation where they can be flexible and they can adapt. And as we saw clearly with Schreiber going out, and, you know, O'Keefe being, you know, Mr. Silky Smooth Dodger / ball carrier in this game, and, you know, Woodward's going, the goals. That was kind of their thing throughout the whole year. I wrote about this a little bit, but it would have been like a 5,000-word article if I kept writing about it. We're talking about like Hasek scored his first two-pointer since he played for the Atlanta Blaze a few games ago, right? And you have Bo Pettersson scoring a goal, but it was that one in Utah. You know, everybody just kept delivering it. I mean, Van Overtime, right? We can go on and on. And without even mentioning somebody like Tom Schreiber, right? We can literally just leave him out of the conversation. And so many other people found ways to contribute that when you look at a team like that, you really just say, okay, they could be a serious threat for quite a while. And it means something to them to be in that position. We heard that a lot this weekend from people like Bates and Dobson and Amen. You know, they really appreciate and respect the prospect of being, you know, a dynasty and a legitimate threat for years to come.
Yeah, a few overarching career points I want to hit on there. Just Dobson from 7 years a starter, second year being the championship MVP, from going as an under-recruited goalie, coming up the ranks to and from the Hill Academy to St. Bonaventure was the only school that offered him. He goes there, balls out, becomes an All-American by his senior year and leads the nation in field save percentage, rather. Just a great arc from the standpoint of just always dreaming, always keeping that long goal in sight, and it is worth that work ethic. When you hear him talk, it's just the way he talks about watching film is it's infectious. Like, it makes me want to just watch another like 7 games in a row and chart all these tendencies and everything. So it is cool to see that he loves honing in his craft. The whole Ament and O'Keefe winning together back-to-back years after not being able to do so at the college level at Penn State, I think that's really cool. Doing it both in Philly area, Ament assisted that those first two, I think, or the last two O'Keefe goals in that game. So cool moments for those guys, especially O'Keefe being the journey from hamstring injuries the last couple seasons to his evolution as a midfielder. Just you heard the Friday answers he gave during the pre-championship press conferences and the maturity in which he speaks about wanting to improve upon his midfield position in the offseason, I think really stands out. And he's like, hey, I'm only like getting started with this. Now I have a whole full off season to prepare on the stuff I want to get better at as a midfielder. So, Schreiber, he told, I think, Kark in one of those interviews that he wants to be vying for one of those Olympian spots. So, no getting rid of him. And we mentioned it, like the long-term building of that defense with Jeffrey and Hasek and now Woodward is just... they are primed for a three-peat bid. That curse was ended this year when the champions, the very next year, since the Whips were able to repeat, had been the runner-ups that next year, right? So, Whipsnakes, they were the runner-up in 21 when the Water Dog, the Chaos beat the Water Dogs. So that wasn't a thing. But point still stands for the Archers' three-peat bid. Yeah, you think, look at their free agents talking to Hasek on the field post-game. He said, we hope we can stay together for as long as we can. So he's a pending free agent. Grant Ament, Matt Moore, Latrell Harris didn't even play this season. He was the D-Midi of the year, Rosie, the year before. So, they're stacked enough to three-peat and do that thing, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. You know, age won't really be a huge concern. And getting those guys back, I mean, if winning 2 in a row doesn't make you want to come back to the team, you must have, like, a serious problem with the locker room or something like that, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, like, what else are you doing this for? if it's, you know, I mean, the honestly, like the cash difference probably isn't going to be that significant where else you go. Maybe if you want a different role, I guess. But man, winning is so awesome. You probably just want to keep winning, right? I
would. That's not because Matt McMahon, bless it, what a great career he had with the Archers. He did retire in the offseason.
Yeah.
It was really cool that like he wore 77 and Mason Woodward comes in also. He wore 77 all through college too, which is like kind of a cool jersey number fit. But Bates, yep. I forget what he called him post game, but he's like
Freak 2.
I don't know where that comes from, saying Matt McMahon is Freak 1, the original Freak.
Apparently, yeah, I didn't know either, but I guess apparently maybe they called because, you know, Dobson and, you know, Grant Amon laughed about it. So I'm guessing somewhere along the line they used to call Matt McMahon Freak. And fortunately, they've got a Freak 2 now, so they're good to go in that department.
Rosie, I want to shift to the offseason here. Congrats, Archers, on your brilliant 2024 championship win. Looking forward here, like, who is most primed for a challenge for the stop this Archers would be? Before you answer that, what is the dynasty cutoff? Is it like you have to win 3 in a row to be in the conversation for a dynasty, or are the Archers in a current dynasty right now?
So I think it's kind of relative based on the length or based on the age of the league. They feel like a relative dynasty, but ordinarily I wouldn't call 2 a dynasty. Yeah,
that's fair.
If they grab another one, then I would say that, you know, I guess they would be a dynasty and would have to be kind of the first dynasty. I guess it would kind of be a degree of whip snakes erasure, but I'm okay with that. So, you know, if they get to win another one, I will say that the Archers will be the league's first dynasty.
That bubble season was so different, too. Like, it's not that... this is not a racer at all, of course. It was...
I hear you, though. It's tricky. It's tricky, right? Like, you don't want to do it because, you know, everybody was suffering through the same challenges in the bubble, right? And everybody faced the same things. But also, there is an inherent sort of, you know, you're kind of like, well, you know, you're not traveling every week. Maybe it would be different. You know, maybe it's tougher to win if you've got to go to all the different cities and stuff. But I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to do it. I understand if someone might.
No, I'm with you. Yeah. Let's not go there. Let's not. And you look at what the whips bring back, like the fact that I think I was telling you this on Friday night at the end of season award ceremony, which we'll have a couple takes on before we sign off here. It felt like the end of the college season a little bit with the team going for the repeat bid against a Maryland team that overachieved and getting there and kind of fell up flat towards the end of the game. Oversimplifying, of course, but at the same time, you got to be happy with the youth movement that the Whipsnakes had this year and notable free agents, some guys that, you know, they could even get even younger. Tim Muller being so integral to that close defense. Kyle Bernlohr stepped into a backup role this year. Jake Bernhardt has been the captain D-Mitty, so it'll be a big leadership loss if he hangs it up or goes to play with Jesse or something. Mike Chanichuk, also getting up there in age, veteran midfielder. Just some of the guy like stands out because I think free agency will be super fascinating because it is such a poor draft class this year, coming after a generational class with O'Neal Schellenberger, Pat Cavanaugh, and the depth that really the Whipsnakes probably benefited most from. I mean, hard to say that when Atlas had 3 of the 5 Rookie of the Year finalists. They had the Atlas and the Cannons are really interesting. Both have a lot of free agents that they need to make decisions on whether to bring back or not. That'll be interesting to follow. Draft order, really, just we know CJ Kearse is going first to the Water Dogs. Any other team, like, what other season predictions should we give before moving on to the next couple topics here? Like,
well, so I do want to say, because I think I dodged this accidentally when you asked it before, as far as, you know, who we might see next year in this same championship spot.
Yes.
I would say Archers again. There's no reason for me to not think that based on the history of the PLL. They will certainly be back to defend once more. And then I think maybe we see Atlas put it together, you know, and make a legit run for it. Just because they have so many talented players who are now going to have a full season experience under their belts, right? You know, you're going to have Entman the entire time. You know, we're going to have another year of that defense working together and, you know, being healthy instead. You know, we've heard Mike Pressler talk about the difference in Adler between his first year and his second year. And, you know, having seen him in the second year, I believe him that, you know, there was a significant, you know, injury he was dealing with and he wasn't able to get up to 100% as a rookie. So, you know, you get him back there and everybody just working together on that defense again. And just the pieces put into place, you know, if Schellenberger stays healthy longer this time around, and, you know, certainly a possibility. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot that could be pushing in their direction to maybe put it together and take an additional step. Largely, we kind of see that piece by piece building in the league. So I would say, and I don't think it's that ridiculous to think that a team that started out as high as they did this season maybe puts together two really good halves and enters the championship next year, looking to finally win one.
Yeah, no, a pipe shot away from the championship game this year. I think it was a matchup that a lot of fans wanted to see, Archers versus the Atlas, coming into this postseason. So I think it's a great shot. A little bit of a silly forgetful, Rosie. We both picked the Atlas going into the playoffs. We were proven wrong. Will they prove us right next year? But yeah, taking that next leap from they've been kind of inconsistent year to year from with all the turnover historically, but you got to think building off this year will have their best off season mindset wise yet. So leaving Subaru Park, we had a little bit of a media gathering up and asking this very question, season predictions. I threw out like a super wild, just like top of the tongue matchup for next year's championship game that everyone was aghast at, really. They were like, Kevin, oh my. So I said, Philadelphia Water Dogs will make the flip from losing all their one goal games to winning them next year with the historic second year jump of the head coach, with Pressler proving it's possible this year. Can Bill Tierney follow his path next year? And against the Denver Outlaw squad, who was very inconsistent because of their youth, question marks with Manley and Bernhardt. Do they retire? Do they come back? Can you replace them in the draft and free agency? If not, a lot of young pieces to like on the offensive end, though, Rosie. So I'm sticking with it. I'm going wild with it.
Why would you not? You know, why not? It's September. Why not say something like that? Maybe it'll turn out to be true. It wouldn't be the wildest thing we've seen in this league, right? I think if anything has kind of been hammered in our heads over the past few years, it's we can see teams turn around one way or another very quickly. So yeah, you know, maybe you see the Water Dogs get back there. They're gonna still have a lot of that same talent. You know, Michael Sowers is not retiring or anything like that. And you know, we will They have a lot of attack or offensive minded guys who didn't really even see the field much this season. So you know, maybe they start rolling some more people out. Maybe they have everything they need already in that locker room. We'll see. I am not going to say either of those teams will definitely not have what it takes to make it there. We'll see.
Speaking of Rosie, just the guys that really didn't touch the field too well, they were in and out a little bit, specifically Thomas McConvey, but even more specifically from my next topic, Matt Brando, the eighth overall pick. Rosie, I don't want to give you like both sides negotiating kind of talk here, but like off-season trades are always like fun to ponder from the aspect of like, all right, who was underutilized this season and who really struggled in that area around the league? Chaos, Redwoods, stick to those two from a primary ball handling, because you still have Rob Pinnell. Primary offensive guy to rejuice the offense. Look at guys like Pat Cavanaugh coming through the box all year, Rosie. Like, I want Chaos to, like, make a good push for him. They've got, what, the sixth pick in the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth pick in the first round next year. Pair him up with Chris if it didn't work out with Matt, you know? Like, that offense, only putting up one goal is obviously going to be talked a lot in the offseason, being a historic worst ever production for a single game.
Right.
Coming at the wrong time. But look at guys like Pat Cavanaugh, Matt Brando, Chaos. Can you send some picks? Can you send some players to pry these guys away? Or you think you can stick to the free agency route a little more?
Well, so it is really interesting to try to figure out what Carolina is going to do in that situation as far as an offense that, you know, of course, the one goal game, but they, you know, they certainly had their fair share of very lowly offensive games throughout the season, right? So how do they turn that around? A lot of it comes down to how much Andy Towers thinks needs to be changed. Because, you know, when they advanced to the semifinals, you know, basically what he's saying is he was like, you know, we just got to score enough goals to win. You know, we just, like people don't understand. We just have to score enough to win. It's we've got a strong defense and blah, blah, blah. All we got to do is, again, score more than the other guy. So I understand what he's saying, but the interesting position that he's in, that every coach is in to some degree, is being the general manager as well. When do you kind of decide this is not great, and how much loyalty do you feel towards the guys you drafted, or, you know, or extended or traded for, or things like that? And, you know, he in particular, we hear a lot, you know, he says, you know, I've got the best, you know, player in this position, this that position. I think he drafts guys and trades for guys that he really, really, you know, loves and supports and thinks are awesome. And then if a situation like this presents itself, when does the GM kind of tap the coach on the shoulder? I was talking to a coach before the season started about being a coach versus a GM. And what he said is it's tough because the coach always loves his guys, but the GM always just like hates his guys, right? You just want them out. If they're not working, you want them out. But the coach is like, no, this could work. He's a great locker room guy or something like that. But the GM doesn't care if the locker room's good. The GM needs the results. He needs the wins. He needs the championship. So what does Chaos identify their roster as right now? I don't know. I'm very, very curious to find out what the future is going to hold. Maybe they run it back exactly the same. You know, maybe they say, why would we even need a Pat Cav coming through the box? We've got an Auburn and Dauber coming north-south, so who needs them? I don't know. It is, Andy Towers is a very fascinating read on that sort of thing. I don't know where they go from here.
Like, Dane Smith, I think his contract is up. Back-to-back Man Cup champion. Lyle Thompson, his contract is up with the Cannons. You don't think they can, like, they can't go back and try to convince box guys to continue playing after making that, oh, we're overhauling the whole offensive philosophy, and, like, we're going without you type of attitude all season and going our own way. But after it didn't work in the playoffs, you fall that flat, and you're like, hey, guys, please, you got to come back. Dean Smith, please. We'll go back to box-style offense?
I haven't heard from Dane Smith personally, but I'll tell you this. Based on social media, it looks like the Six Nations Chiefs are having a really good time being Six Nations Chiefs. I am not sure any of them are begging to come back and hop back on the PLL grind. They can just hang out up there. Like, I'm not expecting to see Lyle Thompson ever again in a PLL uniform. I am also not expecting to see Dane Smith ever in a PLL uniform. Maybe he comes back. I don't know what he's up to. I don't know what he feels like doing with his summer. But it sure looks like they're having a good time up there. And it seems to be going very well for them, you know, as far as success goes and all the trappings that come with it. So I'm inclined to think we're not going to see them back. And, you know, maybe you send a phone call or you have one of their buddies ask them if there's any interest. But I definitely don't expect to see anyone back. The real question is, if you can make sure the guys who are currently having such a great time up there don't do any more recruiting and telling their existing yes, you know, could be anybody, who knows, but you really just got to make sure that, you know,
yeah, anybody, right,
anybody, you know, get on a group chat, who's to say. You just do not want them to, you know, get any of their friends to leave their current teams, you know, be it Carolina or whoever, and, you know, have them head up north as well.
Rosie, we're stirring stuff. We're stirring shit right now with Chaos Nation. We apologize, but it's what happens when you kind of bow out in the season with that kind of performance. So, gotta give it to you. Gotta give it to you a little bit. Are there any other, like, trade targets that you would single out from a guy that was maybe underutilized this season that could have a bigger impact on maybe a different team, fresh start situation?
So, you know, not to hammer this one team too much, but like I mentioned, the Water Dogs have some guys who rarely saw the field, so maybe they can send them somewhere else, you know, exchange for some draft picks or something like that. You know, if they do feel like they are part of the future of the organization, then, you know, maybe they stick around another year, or if there's going to be a little bit of turnover in that Water Dogs offense. You know, we do know Caraway is already retired. What is Kieran McArdle going to do? I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, that'll be big, right? Because the guy behind him, Michael Bame, played in the last game, but yeah, to your point, like, did the Cannons trade for him to solve their lefty attack issue?
Right, yeah. I would certainly say it's worth looking, you know? I mean, we've already seen, we saw Ryan Conrad go. So, you know, Bill Tierney does answer his phone, right? He's not entirely ruling everything out. So, you know, I would say, yeah, it's a perfect example, like you mentioned with the Cannons. You know, if you are looking for, you know, maybe like a lefty solution or something like that, maybe you give him a call and see. Then I do have to wonder if Tierney kind of enters this offseason with a different sort of mindset now that he has a year's experience under his belt. Maybe he thinks a little differently about the roster he needs, and Copeland guys may not be the guys he thinks he needs top to bottom to have a successful team. But yeah, so I mean, the first team that comes to my mind is the Water Dogs in that department. Is anybody else you're kind of thinking might be someone to look at in that regard?
No, that's a great shout. I'm just thinking of teams that, like, have so much depth, like the Atlas had so many weapons. Who do you, like, when Schellenberger couldn't go, you saw McGovern go in, you saw Malloy earlier in the season. Does he get a shot somewhere else? You saw, like, Miles Jones is a free agent. The swap deal with Romar kind of was best thing for both of them. So, like, those type of, like, marginal fringe moves I wrote about a lot with the Whip Snakes season. To put together those amount of, like, deals on the fringes and on the like obscurity of not like major breaking news, but hey, you're trading for Conrad, you're trading for Levi Anderson. These are difference makers in your lineup. So, no other, LeClaire, Moore, can they, like, is someone going to keep getting injured in the Archers' postseason runs that, like, they just keep on getting bigger roles in these title games? And, like, Bowering didn't get a shot for Atlas this year. He made the roster, but I think ended up not really I think he played one game. He came from the Archers when he played in that one game, so... in the championship 2023.
Yeah, Bowering is a really good example of somebody who, you know, did kind of make the most of a limited opportunity last year and then kind of went with that and carried it onto a new team. You know, there was probably a way they could have gotten him to come back, but in his situation, he's like, well, if I come back, am I just going to, you know, sit all year and get called up if something happens? Maybe I can go to another team and maybe get more of a shot. You know, again, it's a maybe. And again, you know, he's not an everyday starter, even on his new team. But yeah, I can understand somebody like that switching a team or maybe inquiring if he could work out some sort of deal so he could leave one team or go to another. Name we haven't discussed maybe ever on this podcast, Alex Simmons. Is he going to play anywhere next year? Maybe somebody reaches out and lets him do a little something. I think he played one game with the Redwoods.
Him, Ryan Lee, when he's finally healthy, and Westberg cannot all be coming out from the box playing the same role. So maybe you package a couple of those guys together, and you got yourself a little, who knows? Like, they mismanaged the Chris Gray situation so badly last year that it's like, well, like, I just keep going back to the Cannons. Like, can we see a full Kavanaugh attack line in the PLL? Someone going to like sack up and let Pat, Chris, and Matt all play together? I don't know. Like, Asher Nolting and Marcus Holman have formed such a great partnership. But disappointing playoff games, yes. But you don't want to break that up. And maybe you just give my boy Mike Robinson a little blue hand, a little love. Give him another chance. I don't know. Like, it'll be fun to see what kind of fringe moves, what kind of free agency stuff happens. Make sure to keep it locked in on all IL socials and follow us too as well. Rosie, I'll leave off with this. Any coaching changes should we suspect in the off season? Or are we keeping the same eight head coaches going into 2025?
I am very curious on that. I do not know. And it's really tough to say based on the kind of pattern that the league has established regarding coaching changes. Basically, to the best of my knowledge, coaches, we don't really hear about any of them being dismissed. It's generally they are leaving. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. If I tell you to get out of my house, you are also leaving my house, right? So I can tell everyone you're leaving. I don't really get into the why. I don't know. I'll say this from a personal note. I would like to see everybody come back because they're all very fascinating people for uniquely different reasons. But, you know, if you are, you know, deep inside of, you know, if you like watching the press conferences that they put out on Twitter and things like that, all the coaches provide a lot of interesting insight. And they all have a good understanding of, you know, this isn't just like a regular coaching gig, right? You know, you're going to have a microphone on you and you're going to have all this kind of inside access kind of stuff. You have to know that getting into it, and they've all signed on and bought into all of that stuff. So I honestly hope they all come back. Granted, it is a business, and you know, you don't want one team to be, you know, a laughing stock or anything like that. But you know, if you've had a bad year or two, I like giving you a chance to kind of turn things around. So I would not advocate for anyone losing their jobs. But again, also, it is a business, so I wouldn't be surprised if we see not everybody coming back this year. But I really don't know. Again, this is it's going to be a super fascinating offseason, as they all are. And I was so pumped to take a break and sleep a little bit and not write about it. And now during the podcast, all I want to do is start like searching around and trying to figure out what's going on this offseason now.
Yeah.
So you have ruined my vacation.
What's next? Tell us. We need to know. We need to move on to the next thing.
No, it's, hey, the league is in a great spot. You said it great there. Just the coaches, year six, up and down. The first year with home markets, complete success. And let's leave off with this, Rosie, because I think it was a great way to end off finish off the final press conference of the season. Dobson and Bates were asked what it means to bring a championship home to Utah. Of course, Bates gave this super nice, like, thought-out explanation that he kind of reiterated after the homecoming weekend. Worked out that it was their final weekend of the regular season to hoist their banner and for that to be the, like, spurring on moment of their championship run. They win both games, win the Western Conference, bunch of momentum after up and down 5-4 seasons at that point. Win their last four games. So, momentum worked, and Chris Bates definitely thanked the Utah faithful for their role in lifting that one against the Outlaws. Pettersson had that amazing pickoff goal, pick six, the Utah native. And then Dobson comes. Well, that was after Dobson came in with the answer of the year. I'll have to think of something to add to the theme song in this intro. By now, you've probably already heard it. So go back and listen to, you can go through championship history with my clips and the intro theme song. But Dobson, how about him, man? Give the listeners what he told us.
Yeah, super probably quadruple shout out to Dobson at this point, man. Just not only the MVP of the championship game, the MVP of championship weekend, Friday through Sunday. The man is a legend. Racing stripes on the side of his head, just for good luck heading into this, heading into the supreme ultimate performance. Yeah, man, I can't wait. Does it get bleeped out? What is the edit? Can I just say it? I don't know if the podcast.
You can say it. You can say the clean version.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if it's the last podcast of the year, I'll just say it's the unedited version.
Perfect.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brett Dobson with the quote of the year. Let's raise another fucking banner.
Boom. How can you not love him, Utah fans? How could you not love this league? What a season. Thank you, PLL, for another fantastic summer. Thank you, Rosie, for talking it all with me in and out each week. And thank you to all our guests. And thank you, of course, most importantly, to you listeners. If you like what you heard, hear a review. If you didn't, then keep silent. And we'll be back with more Inside Lacrosse podcast throughout the week. And, of course, next season for the seventh year of PLL.